WBEZ's Natalie Moore learned one of her books is banned in New Jersey prisons, and she's not the only one.
It's a very extensive list, like Wine Spectator is on there, Popular Science was on there, The Art of War was on there, and then, lo and behold, Almighty Black Peace Donation.
Plus, women can now order tests for the genetic mutations that increase the risk for breast cancer without having to see a doctor, but what's more convenient for customers may not work best for patients. And grad students might be much more likely to experience depression. Here's University of Kentucky professor Nathan Vanderford speaking to the Sigma Xi Society.
For me, it was everything from your experiment that day didn't work, and you know it might have been several weeks worth of working up to the point of trying to get data for this experiment, and then it ended up not working.
That's all coming up on this Encore edition of The 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the special Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The U.S. has had prison libraries for almost as long as the country has existed. And even though prisoners don't have very many options in terms of leisure time, books in prisons can be an important resource, both while people are incarcerated and once they're released. But not all books are allowed in these libraries. There are more restrictions on prison libraries than your typical public library. About 10,000 books, for example, are banned in Texas prisons, including Freakonomics and A Charlie Brown Christmas. Earlier this year, New Jersey made headlines for banning a popular book on mass incarceration called The New Jim Crow. This made the news after the ACLU of New Jersey got its hands on a list of banned books in state prisons there. And one of those books that's also banned is by a journalist here in Illinois. WBEZ Chicago reporter Natalie Moore discovered that her book, called The Almighty Black Peace Donation, The Rise and Fall of an American Gang, was also on the banned books list. Natalie joined us back in January, and I started by asking how she found out that her book was banned in New Jersey prisons.
I found out via Twitter, and I found out from Natalie Hopkinson, who I co-wrote my first book with, and she said, hey, she tweeted a list that the ACLU of New Jersey did a Freedom of Information request to the New Jersey Department of Corrections asking for their list of banned books, publications, and then it's a very extensive list. A very odd list, like Wine Spectator is on there, Popular Science was on there, The Art of War was on there, and then, lo and behold, Almighty Black Peace Donation.
So, if people can't tell from your title, your book that you wrote is about the history of one of Chicago's probably most famous or infamous street organizations, the Blackstone Rangers. Can you explain a little bit more to our listeners about the book?
Sure. So the subtitle of the book is The Rise, Fall, and Resurgence of an American Gang. The Blackstone started on the south side of Chicago in the Woodlawn neighborhood in the 1960s. And the book is really a social history. There are three major policies, federal policies, that intersected with the organization: the war on poverty, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism. The gang got money in the 1960s through a church in Chicago to fight poverty. And then when the war on drugs was launched in the 1970s, Reagan in the early 1980s decided to use RICO laws to hit street organizations when at that time they were only being used for the mob. And then finally, when the gang became the El Rukins, they were the first Americans convicted of domestic terrorism in the United States, and that was for a relationship that they had with Gaddafi, the former head of Libya.
And so you detail in the book about Jeff Fort being the first person ever convicted of domestic terrorism. He is in solitary confinement in Colorado, right, Natalie? Do you think that's why the book is banned? It's kind of hard, I guess, to figure out why.
I have not talked to the folks there. There are a number of books on that list that might suggest, you know, so-called street literature. That would be novels, fiction about you know, urban life, and that could be gangs, it could be crime. The list was so long that I have a hard time believing that this was a list that was truly vetted.
Right, because I don't think Wine Spectator magazine falls into street literature, right?
Right. I don't know, just because it's alcohol. Like, there's so many questions. And I think that there was probably an assumption made, oh, well, this book is about the gang, and gang members populate our prisons, and therefore we don't want them to get any ideas, so we're going to ban this book.
How did it make you feel hearing that your book was banned in a prison?
Well, I have a number of friends that you're in great company. If you look at, Michelle Alexander being on that list, I can't say that I was 100% surprised. I think that there increasingly seems to be curtailments on what people can read in prison. I just finished reading Danielle Allen's book, Cuz, and that's a book, she used to be a professor at the University of Chicago, and it's about her cousin who was in prison. And so it's a family story, but she talks about at one point she wanted him to get a degree from University of Indiana, but he couldn't take the classes because the type of textbook was banned from prison. So I was aware that not everything gets in through prison. And then New York Department of Corrections, just this week, I've seen some stories about how they're curtailing what books are donated. And we're talking about books in prisons, and it goes to this idea that our prisons are no longer really places where there's rehabilitation going on. And when you start curtailing things like books, and books don't always have to be about getting a degree or getting education. Books, like, you're in prison, you want to read. It can be entertainment. It can, you know, there are many different reasons to get pleasure out of reading.
That's WBEZ Chicago's Natalie Moore. She's also an author. This is one of her books that she co-wrote, The Almighty Black Peacestone Nation, The Rise, Fall, Resurgence of an American Gang. Natalie, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'm joined now by Jenny Volen-Katz. She's the executive director of the John Howard Association. They're a nonpartisan prison watchdog group that's based in Chicago. Hi, Jenny. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Jenny, to Natalie's point about how people in prison read and sort of the whole notion of how we're looking at prison systems, whether there are, even the whole point of whether or not they're rehabilitative or not. Let me just ask you about sort of whether or not most prisons in Illinois, do they have their own libraries, or is it just some prisons in Illinois that have libraries?
So they do have libraries, but in 2002, there are law libraries, and then there are libraries for other kinds of reading, for non-legal materials. Having a law library in a prison is something they have to do under federal law. Having the other kind of library for non-legal materials is really is optional. And in Illinois in 2002, the line item, budget item that funded that was taken away. So it's really been a struggle to get books, new books, into Illinois prisons.
Jenny, I wanted to ask you a little bit about if you can maybe help us understand what goes into the thinking behind this. Obviously, I think we all understand that prisons are not democracies. And Texas banning, for example, a pop-up edition of A Charlie Brown Christmas makes sense. There's no need for adults to have pop-up books. You can hide contraband in it, but other things like banning Freakonomics or The Color Purple, while books by white nationalists like David Duke or Mein Kampf, that's okay. So it makes me wonder who decides which books are allowed and which ones get banned.
Well, that's a really good question, and you are not the only person asking that question. So one of the problems is, you know, first of all, every state does it differently. And then in Illinois, pretty much every facility does it differently. So there is one overarching guideline, an administrative directive that spells out, you know, in broad terms what's to be considered. And it basically establishes that each facility should have a publications review committee. and that committee is charged with reviewing the various publications and books to determine whether or not they're appropriate to be inside a prison. And I think the complicated part comes next, which is the guidelines are so broad and so, you know, can be interpreted in so many different ways that you get the kind of results that you just spoke about when you pointed out what books, you know, have traditionally come in and have not come in. And it's really hard to understand what the reasoning would have been for those decisions. And so I think that a big part of the problem is that the criteria is overly broad. It's also not made public. So there, you know, people don't really understand what the guidelines are. There's very little transparency around this. There's also very little opportunity for input beyond this publications review committee. And by the way, you don't necessarily know who's on that committee in each prison.
What reasons do you think prison systems have for restricting access to certain books, Jenny?
So, I mean, certainly, as you point out, there are legitimate safety concerns that have to be taken into account when deciding what, you know, anything that can and cannot come into a prison. However, you know, the way almost every policy is written when it comes to, you know, a Department of Corrections, state agency, the prisons they run, the Federal Bureau of Prisons, you know, there's almost always some language about preserving the safety and security of the institution. And it is that phrase that allows prisons to make a lot of decisions that a lot of us question with very little reason being given. So under that, you know, that, and that extends to pretty much every decision, every policy that is made in a carceral setting. So, for instance, in Illinois, some of the articulated reasons that a publication would not be allowed into a facility would be that the material is obscene, with very little definition given to that, that it encourages hatred, that it encourages commission of a crime, that the material is detrimental to security or rehabilitation, discipline, or order within the prison. Those are really, I mean, under just using that kind of language, you could pretty much come up with a reason to ban anything. So it's, and I think the directives and the policies are written to give prisons that kind of authority and that kind of flexibility in decision making. And it can be really detrimental to the incarcerated population. You know, we want to encourage them to read, to grow, to be interested in education, to do things that will allow for change. You know,
yeah,
we want
Jenny,
to promote
rehabilitation. I wanted to ask you about that too. How important are books in prisons for prisoners? How often are they used?
Oh, I think they're very important. I think they are, you know, first of all, they provide an escape. They provide an activity, you know, let alone the opportunities for education, you know, just promoting, I mean, you know, reading leads to pro-social and positive changes. In fact, there's an organization in Illinois, they're called the 3 R's, and those R's stand for Reading Reduces Recidivism. And, you know, they point towards research and articles that show, you know, that there are real positive impacts that come from supporting and encouraging inmates to read.
So in your mind, ideally, what would it look like, a list of what literature should be allowed in prisons from the perspective of the John Howard Association?
Right. Well, first of all, I think that the Publications Review Committee, you know, should be transparent. And I think any list of criteria or list of specific books or publications that can't come in should be made public. I think that that list should be open to scrutiny. I think that they should take input from inmates, from the loved ones of incarcerated individuals, from other stakeholders. You know, ideally, your Publications Review Committee would include some sort of external input so that there is other information coming into that committee so that the consideration could be based on broader factors and perspectives. So I think, you know, I think also taking into consideration the viewpoint of people in the profession like librarians would be very helpful. You know, we hear stories all the time in our youth facilities in Illinois about, you know, books that receive national awards that the facilities will say, no, can't come in. And, you know, I think there has to be a balance. You know, safety definitely has to be at the forefront of the minds of correctional professionals. On the other hand, there has to be room to consider some of these other books and publications and the benefits that they bring to an incarcerated population. And so I think a more balanced process and a more transparent process might yield better results for everybody.
Jenny, we just have about a minute left, but I just wanted to ask you, we mentioned about New Jersey and the ACLU getting involved. Are there legal options for groups or individuals in Illinois who want to challenge bans?
I don't really know. I mean, there are certainly internal processes for filing grievances and pursuing them. In terms of legal options, I think it would look a lot like what it does in New Jersey. And frankly, in Illinois, I wouldn't be surprised if the organization counted on to pursue this kind of legal remedy wasn't the ACLU of Illinois.
So there was, and the New Jersey ACLU got the information from the banned books list through a FOIA. So just kind of interesting to note that. I want to thank Jenny Volen-Katz. She's executive director of the John Howard Association. They're a prison watchdog group for Illinois based in Chicago. Jenny, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Anyone with a family history of breast cancer has probably wondered, do I carry the gene that makes me more at risk for the disease? It's a concern that's been heightened in recent years by an increased awareness of public figures like Angelina Jolie, who, being carriers of a gene that's linked with breast cancer, opted to get a preventative mastectomy. Until now, the only way to find out about your genetic risks when it comes to cancer was to see a doctor and ask him or her to order tests. But the Food and Drug Administration has just approved the first test that Americans can get without a doctor. And the company 23andMe is offering a testing kit direct to consumer for three specific mutations that increase one's risk for breast cancer. Shirley Wu is the company's director of product science. She's on the line with us now from Mountain View, California. Shirley, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Shirley, how does this work? What does someone want to do if they would like to test their genes or their genetic history in terms of being a risk for breast cancer?
It's a very simple process. So a consumer can just go online and buy a kit, and the kit arrives at your home, and you send back a saliva sample, and in a few weeks, you receive your results in a secure online account.
And what is the results? What do the results say?
So our product includes many results, but for this particular test for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 selected variants report, a consumer would receive a report about these three specific genetic variants, and the report would tell them whether they have one of these variants. If they don't have one of these variants, it does not mean that someone is free of risk from breast cancer or ovarian cancer, since these are just three variants out of many thousands in this gene. And there are many other genes and other factors that also contribute to cancer. But if someone does have one of these variants, it is incredibly meaningful. The risks for breast cancer go up to 85% by the age of 70, and for ovarian cancer, around up to 40%. And for men, there's also a risk. So their risk of breast cancer is also increased. So this information is incredibly useful to know, and individuals can work with their doctors to understand what next steps might be appropriate for them, including getting that result confirmed before taking any medical action.
And what, how does that work when they get the results? Is there help for people to interpret them? Is that service, is the, do you provide services for that as well?
So before someone actually sees their results, we actually require people to read some additional information and decide for themselves whether they would actually like to receive that information. We understand that receiving information about risk for cancer can raise a lot of questions, and some people would prefer not to know. So we actually do require people to choose specifically if they would like to receive it or not. And if they do, then before they see the report, we also ask them to view an educational module. So this is just a few short set of slides that contain information that just help them understand more about what this report can and can't tell them, what the potential risks are, and all the different factors that go into whether someone develops cancer, as well as what to do with those results afterwards. So the report itself provides, again, a lot of that information and points them to resources such as genetic counseling and support groups for additional help.
And Shirley, I mentioned the FDA just approved this. What kind of response have you all gotten at 23andMe for people who are requesting the testing for these specific mutations of the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes?
The response has been really, really promising and heartening. Obviously, there are people that have concerns about the test because it does cover just these three variants. But these three variants are the most well-studied variants in these genes. So they are scientifically very well-established, and there's great understanding about what they mean in terms of risks for cancer. And so we've seen a ton of interest in the test. People are very interested to find out more, and our customers have been very interested in getting information about this for a long time. So we're very excited to be able to provide access to this information now.
From 23andMe's perspective, what limitations do you think consumers should be aware of when they are using your services?
A big thing to be aware of is, again, the fact that this test does currently cover just these three variants. There are thousands of other variants in the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes that have been linked to risk for cancer. These three variants are three of the most common and the three most well-studied variants. In particular, in people of Ashkenazi Jewish descent, about 1 in 40 people has one of these three variants. And so these three variants are incredibly important for people with that ancestry. And these variants represent about 90% of the hereditary breast and ovarian cancer variants in that population. So it has incredible significance for that population and then for anyone else who happens to have one of these variants.
That's Shirley Wu. She's Director of Product Science at 23andMe, which is making these direct-to-consumer kits available, as we've been discussing, for three specific mutations of the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes that are associated with breast cancer, ovarian cancer, also with prostate cancer. Shirley, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
As many of you listening know, I have firsthand experience with all of this because I was diagnosed with breast cancer last year. If you haven't heard, all of my treatment is finished. I'm doing great. That's thanks in part to our next guest, Dr. Nora Hansen, who's the chief of breast surgery at Northwestern Memorial Hospital, where she also teaches. And she was my surgeon. During the course of this, I also had to have genetic testing, and that's where I also met Carmen Williams. She's a genetic counselor at Northwestern Medicine. Dr. Hansen, Carmen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Diana.
Dr. Hansen, let me start with you. Are you starting to encounter patients who are coming to you because they've gotten testing on their own? Or patients, I don't know how often you've seen patients who've come to you just because they're concerned about their genetic history.
So I see more patients that come with a concern about their genetic history, not that they've had testing yet. I have not seen a lot of I haven't seen any patients who've showed up yet with this 23andMe testing. We have seen patients who come in from testing from their gynecologist for, like, the MyRisk panel, which gives you a large number of different mutations. But most of the people will come to see us who are concerned about their family history or have just been diagnosed with cancer at a young age, and we would recommend genetic testing.
Carmen, as we just heard from the director of product science at 23andMe, I wanted to start with the science. She mentioned the two, that testing looks at three specific mutations of the genes. When we're talking about testing that Dr. Hansen was mentioning, that's a little bit different, right? It sounds like it's a little bit more extensive testing that looks at different genes. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So this is the 23andMe test that they are mentioning in the BRCA genes is looking just at three specific variants in those two genes. The test that Dr. Hansen's referring to and the testing that we typically order will actually include thousands of variants that are evaluated in sometimes dozens of genes. And so it's a far more comprehensive test.
And what does the genetic counselor do? What is your job, Carmen?
Yeah, my job is really to make sure that when I am sitting down with someone, I am looking at their entire family history. We'll usually look at an entire three-generation pedigree, which is just a family tree, showing us all the cancers that have happened in someone's family. We're going to evaluate that and really assess whether there's a high risk for a genetic mutation or whether there's a low risk. And then when it's indicated, we'll offer testing to patients to help them figure out what, if any, genetic mutations there might be. Once we get those results, we will make sure to sit down with patients and talk through the result, however it comes out, whether it's a positive result with a mutation or whether it's a normal negative test result, and make sure that they understand then, based on that result, what their cancer risks are, because even people with normal results have cancer risks, and make sure they're getting the appropriate follow-up.
Carmen, is it concerning to you to hear that people might get these results on their own? And it sounds like Shirley was explaining with 23andMe that there's a video that people can watch or there's maybe some information online. How do you feel about that?
I think that it's concerning to a lot of us in the genetics community. There's, of course, a little bit of concern that someone would come across a BRCA mutation having not really understood what they were actually getting tested for. But it sounds like 23andMe is trying to make sure that they minimize that by providing education ahead of time. However, one of our bigger concerns is actually those who wouldn't fully understand the test, get a normal test result from this saying they don't have any of those specific three mutations, and then would just assume that they don't have any mutations at all.
And as you're saying, there's thousands of other possibilities that could also genetically have someone put at risk for this. That's what you mean.
Yeah, absolutely. There are thousands of other mutations. And I think also very importantly, these three mutations are really only informative in people of Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry. So the chance of finding this in anyone else is anywhere from 0 to 0.1% chance, meaning that someone without Ashkenazi Jewish ancestry, this test is somewhat meaningless.
Dr. Hansen, from a medical standpoint, as a surgeon, what would you like people to know who are doing these tests?
Well, I mean, I think it's very important to understand the implications of both a positive and negative test. And I do think it's very hard for a patient just to look at a short video or a few slides to really comprehend what the impact of the genetic testing is. I did hear that your first guest was saying that it should be repeated before any treatment is done, which seems a little, you know, now the patient's going to have to pay twice for a similar, you know, outcome for that one, those three specific areas. But I just don't think that patients can quite comprehend just from a short video really the impact of what the testing is. And I agree with Carmen that the false sense of security that a negative test would give a patient, I think, is misdirected. It shouldn't be considered a test that's just negative.
Right, because I think
they'll have a higher risk.
Right, so people could, higher risk for other things. Dr. Hansen, when a woman or man is aware that he or she is a carrier, what next steps do you normally advise them to do, to take from there?
So it's a little bit different for men and women, because even though men do have an increased risk, it's still not that high. But we would still recommend for men, breast exams. There's a little controversy about whether or not they should be getting mammograms yearly, and I don't think we offer yearly mammograms to men who are BRCA positive. We do not perform prophylactic mastectomies in men if they're BRCA positive, as we would offer a prophylactic mastectomy for women who were BRCA positive, because I think the men's risk is still relatively low. So usually if someone comes to see me and they have the gene, we'll talk about two options. One would be either close surveillance, and close surveillance would mean breast exams twice a year, as well as increased imaging. So we'd offer mammograms once a year and MRIs once a year, because these patients tend to have a higher rate of interval cancers, or cancers in between your mammograms. So we recommend increased screening. And then the other option would be the prophylactic surgery. And not everyone picks prophylactic surgery. I mean, it's a very individual decision, and it's a discussion that we have with each individual patient. And, sometimes a patient will start with increased screening for a while and then get tired of the screening or the false negatives or false positives, and then they elect to go with the surgery.
Carmen, Dr. Hansen's been talking about steps for also with the BRCA gene, the 1 and 2 mutations. What other genetic mutations are genetic counselors, genetic testing also looking for? I think people always hear about BRCA, BRCA, but there are other genes. What are other genes people should be thinking about or becoming aware of?
Yeah, one of the big ones is actually Lynch syndrome, which is named after Dr. Henry Lynch, who discovered it. There are 5 different genes that we find in patients with Lynch syndrome having mutations. And Lynch syndrome increases the risk of colon cancer up to around a 60 to 70% risk lifetime for both men and women. So for those patients, we need to do a lot more colonoscopies, and we need to start at younger ages. There are other cancer risks with Lynch syndrome, such as uterine cancer, and in some families, things like stomach cancer. So that's another syndrome that is present in the population as commonly as the BRCA genes, and one that we try to keep an eye out for very carefully. And then there are a number of other syndromes a little bit more rare that can lead to breast cancer, such as Cowden syndrome, Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, and hereditary diffuse gastric cancer syndrome. So those are all things that we're evaluating when we look at a family history.
And when you're also looking, you look for mutations for breast cancer as well, other genetic mutations, like I believe, is it PALB2? Is that another gene that you've recently
PALB2 is another gene that can cause high risks for breast cancer. And then there are some other genes that we're still working on defining the best way to care for patients with these, but ATM and CHEK2 are 2 other genes that have a lower impact on breast cancer risk, maybe causing around a 20 to 25% lifetime risk for breast cancer.
So both of you, we just have about a minute or two left, but I just wanted to ask you one last question. As for both of you as medical folks in the medical field, Dr. Hansen, let's start with you. What advice do you have for people as they're starting, as these kits are becoming more popular, more people are doing genetic testing? What advice would you have as to how they approach this? Dr. Hansen?
So I would say, if you're interested in doing it, you should also speak with your, primary care physician and just let them know that you're doing this so that you can have support as well. And I think if you're very worried about your family history, that, it is important that you meet with a genetic counselor to go over it. I think a lot of people overestimate their risk of breast cancer risk and are often fearful. And when they meet with a genetic counselor or with us, they often find that their risk is really not as high as they think. So I just think it's caution when you do tests like this, and education is the most important thing that they can do for themselves.
Thanks for that. That's Dr. Nora Hansen. She's chief of breast surgery at Northwestern Memorial Hospital. Carmen Williams is also a licensed genetic counselor who works in cancer genetics at Northwestern. Dr. Hansen, Carmen, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Welcome back to the special Encore edition of the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Graduate students have a lot on their plate. They're usually taking and teaching classes in addition to writing their own dissertations that can take years to finish and they don't make much money. We heard about that when graduate students at the U of I went on strike earlier this year. That's been resolved, by the way, with higher pay and tuition waivers, no doubt a big stress reliever. So perhaps it's no surprise that a recent study released by Nature Biotechnology says that graduate students are, quote, 6 times as likely to experience depression and anxiety when compared to the general population. That study warned of a crisis in graduate education. I spoke with the two lead authors of the study, Nathan Vanderford and Teresa Evans. Nathan is an assistant professor at the College of Medicine at the University of Kentucky, and Teresa is an assistant professor at the University of Texas's Health Science Center in San Antonio. Getting a PhD can be a unique experience, so I started by asking Teresa to share some common themes about being in graduate school, especially as it relates to mental health.
So from my experiences pursuing a degree, and I should also qualify that that's in the life sciences. I pursued a degree in neuroscience. And, you know, the process is unique in that it's one of the last environments where you're truly an apprentice and you're working not only under your laboratory supervisor and mentor, but also under the mentorship of all of the faculty at your university. And for that reason, you know, as you're going through the process of completing your dissertation, you're often struggling to, you know, find your place at the table. And I think that's what makes it a really unique situation and a unique environment.
Nathan, I wonder if you want to add in as well any other unique experiences people should be thinking about or common themes for modern graduate students?
Yeah, absolutely. So the first couple years of graduate school is really focused on heavy coursework, and a lot of times, particularly in the life sciences, as Teresa and I are both most familiar with, you know, you're doing coursework, but you're also trying to find a lab and a mentor in which you'll do your research for your dissertation project. That can be a very stressful time, trying to find a good mentor and a lab that you can work in. And then the last several years of grad school is much less unstructured, and you're really running at your own pace in many regards and trying to get your research project done and publish some papers and contribute it to the literature and eventually earn your PhD.
Teresa, we should say again in your study, you were, when we say graduate students, you mostly studied PhD students, correct?
So our study includes individuals who also have master's degrees, but the majority of the respondents are PhD students.
And in that, you found that 39% of the people that you surveyed scored in the moderate to severe depression range. How would you define moderate to severe depression, Teresa?
So based on the assessments that we used, we can really only say that these individuals had symptoms associated with, you know, what clinically we would call moderate to severe depression. It's important to note that this is a survey, not a clinical setting where we evaluated these individuals, you know, face to face. And so the definition that I can give you is really only that they're indicating that they're expressing symptoms associated with what clinically we would call depression at a moderate to severe level.
And what kind of symptoms are those, Teresa?
Yeah, so symptoms such as that we asked them to self-report if they'd experienced any stressful events. We asked them to self-report on their habits of ability to sleep and to you know, the stress that they're experiencing in their daily lives. All of the questions that we ask, those particular scales are publicly available. The scales are used regularly. So if anyone's interested, they can look them up.
I would just add to that we use clinically relevant survey instruments for this study. We cite those in the paper. So as Teresa said, individuals could go out and look those instruments up to see exactly what the questions are.
And when we think about this, Nathan, what kind of support systems exist, if any, for PhD students to help them through these challenges? I know, obviously, you can't speak for all of graduate education, but I wonder at least what you all found in your research and your experience. Nathan?
Right. So one thing to point out is we didn't ask this question actually in our study in terms of what resources were available to the respondents. That is a very interesting question. But in terms of what is available to students, it really varies very widely from institution to institution. I can speak mostly about here at the University of Kentucky. We have counseling services that are available. Students, graduate students, and postdoctoral fellows are eligible to go to those sessions, although it's limited in the number of sessions that they can attend in any given calendar year. And then the biggest issue, though, is that trainees, graduate students, postdocs, they don't know about these services. So they don't know that they are available to use. So that's a big problem.
I'm speaking with Nathan Vanderford. He's an assistant professor in the College of Medicine at the University of Kentucky, along with Teresa Evans. She teaches at University of Texas's Health Science Center in San Antonio. They were the authors, two of the authors of this study. We'll tweet that out if you would like to read more about that. And I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Inger Burnett Ziegler is a clinical psychologist and assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Northwestern University. Inger, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you work with students at Northwestern. I wonder what you make of what you're hearing from Teresa and Nathan about the survey they did, just looking in particular at PhD students and how many of them indicated having moderate to severe depression.
Yeah, so I want to first thank Teresa and Nathan for the important work that they have done in bringing this topic to light. I was listening to the discussion earlier around the expectations that are placed upon graduate students and thinking about my own experience in a clinical psychology doctoral program and the experience of students that I work with. And in addition to the demands of the classes themselves, the demands associated with research productivity, clinical psychology students are also expected to engage in clinical work, in practicum. So their time is spread really thin in actual hours and expectations, and that can be quite challenging, particularly when you think about all of the actual things that they have to get done in the day, and then, you know, how one can kind of create a culture of balance within that. I'd also like to add, even though I am a research and clinical mentor to graduate students here at Northwestern, I also occasionally get some graduate students in my faculty practice that are bringing up some of these issues. They have sought out this help for the anxiety and depression that they may be experiencing that is the consequence to the stress that's coming up in their programs.
Teresa, Nathan, if you can weigh in after Teresa, I wonder what other outside forces you're also seeing that are leading to more stress and anxiety, particularly within a graduate school setting. Inger was just mentioning, of course, the workload, which tends to be very intense and even more so when you're in a graduate program. What other outside forces are there? Teresa?
Yes, absolutely. So there are several. The first, in no particular order, but one to consider is even the stress and burden that's put on the mentorship team of these graduate trainees. And so that is in large part the faculty. And so there are papers that indicate that faculty in academic environments are increasingly burnt out and struggling with mental health issues as well. And so as we know in work environments, when the leaders are experiencing these things, it's also an issue then within the team and the individuals that they're trying to lead. And additionally, graduate trainees are often in a period of their careers where they're balancing many things, not only in academic life, but also in their home life. And so work-life balance is a huge issue. And how do we integrate the requirements of our home life into the requirements of our academic training? And finally, something that our paper also investigated and is, you know, only one of its kind to do so are the stresses that
come from diversity, not only diversity in race and in culture, but also diversity in gender. And so these types of issues are all issues that the academic institution and culture really needs to start thinking about how to embrace.
Nathan, you all use this, you call this a crisis in graduate education. Why did you use that word?
Well, I think that Teresa and I and the other colleagues on the paper agree that anecdotally and from our data and other data that has similar work that's been done on this topic, I think we can all agree that these numbers are astronomically high, you know, particularly compared to the general population that's been measured on the same scales that we use. You know, as you said at the beginning, 6 times higher than the general population. And for people who are working in academia, you know, faculty and staff, we can see the stress and strain and anxiety and depression in our students. So we really truly do believe that this is a crisis, and it's only a matter of time until it more negatively impacts not only the students, but higher education as a whole.
Yeah, Inger, I was just going to end by asking you that. What do you think it means, not just for graduate education, but for higher education more generally, if PhD students, graduate students, aren't able to get the support that they need?
Well, I really think that this is raising attention to an issue and calling into question how we can create cultures where we develop students to reach their fullest potential in a way that they will remain healthy and productive at the same time. I think right now we're in a culture where objective measures of productivity are sometimes valued over the quality of the work, not only in graduate school, but also in other kind of high demand settings like corporate settings. And this is really a time for us to do internal analyses within individual graduate programs and think about, you know, the ways in which faculty, mentors, programs overall may be contributing to the depression and anxiety of students, and how we can kind of create a culture shift to make students help them to promote their own self-care.
That's Inger Burnett Zickler. She's a clinical psychologist. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavior Sciences at Northwestern University. I want to thank her, along with Teresa Evans at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and Nathan Vanderford with the University of Kentucky, for being with us. Thank you so much, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
That's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.